Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford lecturer, a writer and a broadcaster, but most importantly, I'm your chief investigator of images. I'm joined by a good friend today, Dr. Adam Rutherford. I know we are going to have a brilliant time today recording this. We will try and keep it on track, Art Detective listeners, because I think we both have the tendency to deviate.
Bit of waffle when we chat.
Yeah. But it's going to be brilliant. So, Adam, you're a scientist, a broadcaster. Yeah. You have your amazing new book out at the moment. Give me the title.
A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. Sort of slightly humble, unambitious title.
Yeah. Don't reach too high or anything, you know. Just everyone who ever lived.
Yeah. But, I mean, notably in that biography, none of the descriptions are art historian, are they?
No. And I am pushing you slightly outside your comfort zone today, aren't I?
Yeah. But I think that I've always been interested in the interaction between science and art, and I think probably the best historically robust interaction between art and science has been in anatomy. And so I'm also quite drawn, I realise this is not a very academic or intellectual thing to say, but I've always been quite drawn to the visceral. I got an unhealthy interest in horror movies.
We've got that in common.
Yeah, well, you know, we're both a bit goth.
We're a little bit goth, yeah. But I think
that drove my interest in anatomical art. And so I've always been interested in anatomy. And
so you went that way, you see, because I think we do have this in common, that I did biology A level against the advice of all my tutors who said, no, darling, you're doing arts and history and the humanities. You don't need biology A level.
Well, biology A level and I became a biologist.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, gosh. So we'll see who's got the better basic knowledge now today.
God, help.
But I think I absolutely love the interaction between, and I think that some of the best artists, as you say, I mean, you've done work on Leonardo, haven't you, in the anatomical drawings?
Yeah.
When you see that biology is absolutely in the service of the arts because of the need for illustration. That was, yes, one of the things I most loved about doing biology, was the amount of time I spent drawing detailed diagrams.
Yes, and that's exactly right. And that is the history of anatomy as well. And it's only really in the 20th century when anatomy becomes properly scientific and properly biologized, and until that point, until medicine becomes a much more scientific vocation, the fusion of illustrating anatomy and illustrating medicine goes back thousands of years, because the father of anatomy is Galen. Mm. And Galen never drew. Mm. And so there aren't any representations of what Galen was talking about in his anatomical works. There's the suggestion that some works of very early anatomy, and we're talking sort of 8th and 9th century in the Middle East, are derived from Galen's work. And so we see physical representations of them. But then it's not until you get to the 16th century when you've got Vesalius writing and drawing the Fabrica, which is the sort of, you know, the real foundation of anatomy for centuries. And that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge, you know, coffee table book. And it has those iconic figures, which are quite gruesome in one sense. But I don't think people thought of them as being gruesome at the time.
Well, I think the other thing that's so interesting about the need for anatomical drawing is, of course, that so much of what it's representing is non-visual. You can't see it. You have to almost conceive of it. And it's a bit like a Chinese whisper, that if one person has managed a dissection and one person has managed to capture that, then the image becomes canonical and it becomes reproduced and filters out. And with the absence of free dissection,
I imagine,
under the church in particular, that inability to actually access the cadavers and do those dissections meant that the images almost become more precious.
I think that's exactly right. And it's not just controlled by the church, which did actually vary over time. And I think that it's you know, a lot of people say, well, we weren't allowed to do this because the church said so. And it's true in some situations and not in others. It's as determined, the infrequency of dissection and the specialness of doing a human dissection is as determined in the past by the weather, because all dissections were done until the 18th century in January because they didn't have any means for preserving the bodies.
Oh my goodness.
So there was an annual dissection celebration in Bologna and in Padua, where Vesalius is.
Because the vessels of the particularly the vulnerable ones in the thorax, they start to go immediately, don't they?
Right, that's exactly right. And there was a particular order in which these, very heavily choreographed performances, these are theatres. The reason that we get operated in today in rooms called theatres is because they were theatres. And people would queue up, and they'd be big events, and they'd be stacked in sort of social hierarchy with students right at the back, and there'd be bands playing. And you've got the top. This is just in Padua, where they've reconstructed.
Sounds like a mad gig.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And then they wheel in the body, and you've got this performance.
Oh my gosh!
And you've got this performance which involves, very staged people. Mm. The instructor who's pointing at things, and he's pointing at the fabrica of Vesalius's book.
Preparator.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great job.
Exactly, and then you've got the person doing the actual dissection. Vesalius changes all of that, because Vesalius is he gets stuck in, and as a young man coming from Belgium and is now in Italy, he wanted to do the dissection himself. Mm. So he was doing all the preparation and dissection and the instruction in front of all these, bigwigs sitting in the first few rows of the Padua Anatomy Theatre.
Yeah.
And so it is it's a heavily choreographed, staged event in a theatre.
It's also incredibly top end, isn't it? It's very high class, the people involved in this. In fact, what we really should do, Adam, is tell the listeners what we're looking at.
Yeah, sure.
Because we had sort of leapt in.
Yeah.
You chose this image. Tell me what you've chosen and why.
Well, this is, as far as I'm concerned, this is singularly my favourite piece of art that has ever existed. And it's the Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Tulp by Rembrandt.
Yeah, you got the Rembrandt. You are the first person on Art Detective to Bagsy, not Simon Sharma, you have Bagsy'd the first Rembrandt on our podcast.
Well, I'm very pleased by that. I find this painting incredibly moving. I think it does play to, slight goth tendencies. It is morbid in a modern sense, but it is incredibly beautiful. I also think it's interesting because it's very odd. The construction, the mise-en-scene is peculiar to the time. It's the first anatomical art, as we've been talking about, is a thing by the 17th century.
Because this is 1632.
And we were talking about the weather and the time of year. It's January the 30th, 1632, because that's the date that this dissection was performed.
And it happened once a year, I was reading.
That's right.
And then once every 5 or 10 years, they would have that event commemorated in a large-scale painting.
Right. And the social hierarchy in the picture is very striking as well, because he's named. It's the Prelector of Amsterdam, who's the sort of chief scientist, and he's Nicolaes Tulp.
Who was also mayor, I read.
Yes, and he changed his name to Tulp, meaning tulip,
yeah,
in order to represent his,
That's dedication to
it. It really is. It really is. It's like me changing my name to Adam Scientist.
Yeah, it is, completely. But I do think that this idea of him being such a prominent member of Amsterdam society, all of that is wrapped up in this as well, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's not just, here he is demonstrating the dissection of the forearm, and he's surrounded by seven surgeons. Mm-hmm. And there's at this time, there's quite a separation between surgeons, surgery and science.
Okay.
And so there he is as the scientific instructor in front of these surgeons. And they've all paid to be there.
Well, this is it. I heard this, that Tulp of all of them has probably paid the most.
Yeah, he's commissioned the painting from a 26-year-old
Rembrandt.
But they're
all being paid to be represented. So this is a fantasy as well, isn't it? We have to emphasize.
Absolutely.
This didn't happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is a representation of an event that took place. We know it's a fantasy for a number of reasons. Not just that it is incredibly staged, obviously, and they are, some of the eye lines are peculiar. We're not quite sure what they're looking at. This guy at the back is interesting, and I forget his name, but these are all real named people. The guy top back.
He looks a bit like Lawrence Fox.
Yes, he does. I'd never noticed that before.
He does look a bit like Lawrence Fox. Yeah, he's sort of staring off into the distance.
Well, I think he's breaking the fourth wall there. I think he's looking at you.
He's looking at us. Well, Rembrandt's brilliant at that. I mean, there is that whole idea of, totally looking out. And the idea that this is taking place dramatically in front of us. I think he's done so much with the light, hasn't he? The light in this.
Well, you could talk about Rembrandt and light for the rest of time and still not get to the bottom of it. Another reason we know it's staged is what we've already mentioned, which is that they're dissecting the arm. And you wouldn't, and nothing else is cut open on this body. Aris Kint is his name, an itinerant criminal who was hanged in January 1632.
And it had to be an executed criminal, didn't
That's
it,
right.
for dissection?
That's exactly right. And we know that this is a fiction because they would always start with the viscera, with the stomach, because that is the stuff that goes off first. Mm. So you get that out of the way before you do anything else. Mm. So the representation of the hand is, well, I mean, you're the expert on symbolism within art, but you know that the hand as an instrument of God, as an incredibly sophisticated thing, that's what they're looking at.
Well, the thing that's so interesting about this is Rembrandt has managed, this is how I understand it, because now I'm throwing it over to you as scientist, he has done this very, very well. He has managed to show details in here that suggests either he had access to anatomical drawings or possibly that he had witnessed something like this.
Yeah.
But the level of detail, it's good, yeah?
It's stunning. There's been a lot of analysis over the years of the actual anatomy on display in this painting. And there's been many studies saying that this can't be right and that this particular tendon or this particular muscle is in the wrong place.
Apparently something is attached to the wrong other thing.
We need Alice Roberts here to explain that. But I think it's all of those, I think it's, many academics have sort of just thrown those out as being a level of pedantry which is either incorrect or not interesting or not relevant. And I think that's the line that I take in this. There's also interesting things about just the social hierarchy going on here too, that Tulp is the only one wearing a hat.
Mm.
That's important. And there's a backstory to that as well. Same guy at the back, who I say is breaking the fourth wall, was painted with a hat. And if you look very carefully, and on this reproduction, we can't really see it because it's print out from a BBC printer. But on the original, you can see that there was a hat.
I can see it from here. It's the brim comes out
there
like
you go.
That, and you can see the overpainting completely. Yeah.
So he has Rembrandt paints in a hat for chap at the back, and Tulp says, hold on a minute, I'm the prelector. I'm in charge of this scene.
Also, I paid more to be in this.
Paint the hat out. The hat goes.
But I do find, I think that the drama of this is, the fact that it is completely fictional is what interests me in a way, because these people have paid to be in this, to be put on the wall. And this is a huge painting as well. We should give the dimension. So what did we say it was? It was
2 meters by
60 something by 1 meter 70.
Yeah.
So it's big. And this idea that they want to be hung in the, well, this would be in the surgeon's, where is this appearing?
Well, now it's held in the Mauritshuis, which is one of the main museums in The Hague, not in Amsterdam. But there are lots of there are lots of display galleries at the time. I'm not sure where it was originally meant to be.
As I say, I know that they were commissioning every few years for display alongside one another, because then Rembrandt does another one later.
Yeah.
He paints his replacement, doesn't he? Tulp's replacement.
That's right.
But I think
Dr. Damon.
And they're very different paintings.
They
we can
are.
Talk about that a bit.
So when you go to the Rembrandt Museum in Amsterdam, it's quite clear that he just collected lots of stuff and painted it. He had receipts and evidence that he bought stuff from butchers. Mm-hmm. And when he went bust a few years after this, and the contents of his existence were inventorized by the insurers. And it included weird stuff like, you know, a pig's foot.
Yeah.
And I think there were some human remains in
there. There were. Honestly, yeah. I mean, because now as well, you can go to Rembrandt's house and they've used the inventory as a way of reconstructing it and giving you the sense of what he would have had in it. But yeah, I mean, he did have all those strange curiosities. And I think that maybe that's where he's getting the inspiration, because I mean, I'm not very good at what I'm looking at here. This is much more your realm. But this is the tendons that he's pulled up here. Is that right?
Yes. So all of the muscles for the hand, there are no muscles in the hand. Well, no significant muscles in the hand itself. All of the muscles are actually in the forearm. Mm. And so you can see, for example, the pulmonaris longus. So if you are to, I know this is radio or podcast, but if you put your...
Adam's basically holding his hand up. Okay.
If you put your thumb and little finger together, mm-hmm. when it's on a flat surface, and then slightly inflect your hand towards your face, then you get a tendon pops up.
Right,
there it is.
So, my hand looks all old and wrinkly when I do that. Yeah, so that little thing there.
So that's one of the tendons. That's the palmaris longus, and that is a tendon which controls various aspects of inflation in the arm. Now you can see that, you know, they've stripped back the flesh, they've stripped back the fascia, and he's holding up various muscles to demonstrate to the surgeons this is what is going on in the forearm. They're also, some of them are overlooking the body, and they're looking at this big book in the corner. Now we think that is the Fabrica. We think that is Vesalius's big work, that he's sort of demonstrating it. But it's these are very different ways of portraying anatomy between Vesalius and Rembrandt, in that the Vesaliuses are very much in sort of reference to classical poses. They're all these, you know, sort of very muscular chaps standing in this beautiful Etruscan landscape in heroic poses as their flesh is slowly being stripped from them.
Nice.
Yeah. They're very beautiful. They're very stylized. And I think this is a move away from that stylized, optimized view of human anatomy and into what eventually becomes the scientific discipline of anatomy, which is that bodies are visceral and grisly, and they're more different on the inside than they are on the outside. And, you know, the word autopsy means to see for oneself, right? So, you know, the idea that they still teach in medical school, and I think it's essential as a concept, you cannot learn surgery or anatomy from a book, but you have to get your hands dirty. You have to get stuck in.
And this is a middle ground. I can see that. I think what's so remarkable about Leonardo is he was anticipating what was coming later, but he was very much, I think, quite an anomaly in terms of the detail, the level of detail he went to in his anatomical drawings. We don't really see that again for a long period.
Well, the story of Leonardo is both brilliant and tragic, because there are, what, 250-odd anatomical drawings he did?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And they're all owned by the queen.
And then it's not just that, because then he does all the things on blood flow, water flow, motion. Yeah.
And none of them have any intellectual impact, because he never published one of them. And so the one that everyone knows is the Vitruvian Man, which is the only one not held permanently by the Queen in Windsor, or Slough, as I like to refer to it.
Thank you. Yeah. Little nod to my hometown.
Yeah, there you go. but you know, very famous images, the nuts, the in utero.
That's amazing. But it is, the in utero baby is just such a stunning drawing.
And then there's another interesting anomalies within that. So there's a very muscular midsection of a woman, but it was quite clear that he'd never anatomized a woman, because the uterus itself is drawn from a cow, and so it has anatomical features which women don't have, suspensory ligaments, of which I think there are seven from memory, that cows have, that hold the uterus in place inside the body.
Oh,
and you don't have them. But on this beautiful, visceral, you know, incredibly detailed, there they are. And you're looking at that going, yeah, as someone who knows a bit about anatomy, I don't really recognise quite a lot of these structures.
No, you know, I find that absolutely amazing, because to me that is what art does. Art fills in the bits we don't know. Art is the product of both looking and imagining.
Yeah.
And actually what he's done is he's gone as far as he can go with his eyes, and then he's had to be creative and draw parallels and work from other examples.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating, and that relates to another, I was teaching this week about the early microscopists, so a little bit later, so late 17th century, also in Holland, in Delft, where Antony van Leeuwenhoek is the first, he's a draper and lowborn, a tradesman, but he makes the best lenses, because you need lenses to look at cloth, look at density of fibres in cloth. But he's also curious about everything, so he looks at rainwater, he looks at stuff between his teeth, he looks at his own blood. And in all of those examples, he is literally the first person in history to see cells.
Wow.
And so the foundation of all biology starts with this guy with a powerful lens looking at stuff that he'd never seen before. But there's this one thing, this is in reference to what you were just saying. So he also looked at his own sperm. And he kept that secret. He didn't publish that, but we have it written in his secret notes.
Boys.
Well, wait. He qualifies this. and this is written down. And I had to say this on the BBC 4 doc a few years ago. He says,
"You're not going to drop the C bomb again, are you?"
No. And again, I'd like to apologise to the listeners. For that. I was quoting someone when
you
I said
were,
that.
You were. No, you're quoting now, and that's what worries me. It's when you start quoting, I start worrying.
Well, he said, this sample was not supplied by sinfully defiling myself, but instead as a byproduct of conjugal coitus.
Oh, God!
And I think that's worse!
Oh, God! Yeah, that's lovely. But the point is, as well, we take a lot of our attitudes towards, I think, the sciences and the humanities, but we're always looking backwards from our modern perspective.
Yes.
And applying our own modern concepts of where we are now backwards. But we have to remember that the idea of defiling yourself was a sin.
Yes.
And so he couldn't, he's having to balance his own curiosity, his own scientific curiosity, with what was permissible socially.
Absolutely, and didn't write it up. Well, he did write it up, but he never published those results. But we still have them. What's interesting about what you're saying about, you know, people seeing things that they, you know, applying a layer of narrative which are not visually represented by what they're actually looking at. He drew his sperm, and he drew them pretty accurately, and that's the first depiction of sperm. Other people with other microscopes drew sperm with homunculuses inside them, homunculi, and where they saw physical bodies, curled up little bodies.
Tiny little baby ready to be made.
And this posed a sort of theological problem, because it also meant that inside that little body, homunculus, is more sperm. Which must contain more little homunculi, and then, you know, it's recursive all the way back.
I also particularly like the way that it completely writes the female contribution out of the
You're just
creation.
A vessel.
Yeah, it just pops into the egg, and then it becomes.
Yes, no, you're an oven. You're an incubator for a complete person that already exists.
Thank you.
It's
a lovely concept. What a wonderful concept.
But there's the narrative. But then what happens is, in a similar way to the development of anatomy as a. As it becomes more medicalized and more scientified, it's not a word.
That's a real word. You've heard it here first.
It is now.
Scientified.
It is that you can't, there's a point where you have to stop imagining things in order to fit the pre-existing narrative. And there's a point where, if this is going to be useful to people, which Vesalius's book was meant to be. I mean, the Fabrica was... a big sort of coffee table book, but there was a sort of student version of it called The Epitome, which was, oh my lord, this is an amazing thing, because it's basically a cut out and keep. So it starts in the middle, and there's a man and a woman who are fully in full physical form in the middle pages. And as you turn the pages left, the woman gets denuded.
Wow.
And as you go right, the man gets denuded. But even better than that, the final couple of pages are the instructions on how to cut out sections in order to overlay them. So you can put the vasculature on, you can put the nervous system on top. And when I was looking at a copy of this in Cambridge Library, they we were sort of lifting them up with wooden spatulas so as to, because they're quite fragile at this point. And I lifted one up and looked underneath it, and I said to the curator, "There's some writing on the other side of this." And he said, "Yeah, basically the instructions say you have to cut them out of the book and then stick them on something." That, you know. So this was the equivalent of a sort of 16th century magazine.
Yeah, it reminds me of some, 1980s cut-out Barbie and put the paper clothes on.
With the tags.
Absolutely.
To put them around the side.
But the thing is, even now my kids have got little plastic sets where they can do exactly that, layer up the organs. Yeah. And it's amazing because we have the ability to conceive of that. I think my children already can conceive of their internal organs through constantly looking at books and looking at, there's so much evidence for them now. But when we're looking at Rembrandt's time, when we're looking at the 17th century, it is almost an unknown and almost an almost a forbidden world.
Yes.
To open up a body it's playing God in a dangerous sort of way. It's looking at the inner workings of what only God can make.
Yep.
That's the sort of theology behind it, that you're actually defiling a product of God, a piece of creation, and trying to understand it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And also it's one of the reasons why it's only the hanged man who gets anatomized.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, this is his final redemption. Yep. This is his gift. Aris Kent in this example,
who was an armed robber,
an itinerant criminal, not a particularly nice guy, but his salvation is in effectively donating his body for the greater good, for knowledge.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I see this painting as sitting between lots of worlds, actually, because it's a step along the way to a much more thorough and scientific anatomical set of illustrations and drawings and paintings that we come to later. But it's still looking backwards. It's still got so much echo of earlier paintings. Yeah. There's something very religious about it.
Absolutely.
The positioning of the body, it's like the arrangement of Christ, and you've got the figures surrounded, all lit centrally.
Very,
there is something
like disciples, aren't they?
Absolutely.
So as far as I'm aware, and I may be wrong on this, but as far as I'm aware, this is the first anatomical painting, first anatomy lesson painting, in which the body is laid out from left to right.
The side, yeah.
So there are plenty of others and contemporaries where there are various bones where they're held upright, mm-hmm. but this is a depiction. You'd be in denial to not say that he looks Christ-like.
Totally. Well, even the laying of the shroud. I mean, there are very famous earlier Renaissance paintings where you have this foreshortening of the Christ laid out after the crucifixion, where you can see the soles of the feet like you can here. I do think the lighting is important. I think this radiance on the body. When you say redemption, that's what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing the kind of the idea that this is not some awful, behind closed doors, weird process that's taking place. These are decent, upright men, intelligent men, yeah, doing something worthwhile with a figure who is redeeming himself through this act.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've seen this painting in reproductions a million times, and I only saw it in the flesh for the first time a couple of years ago. And we've mentioned the lighting, and of course Rembrandt is the master of light. But on seeing it for the first time and approaching it, the body glows,
uh-huh,
and it is apart from the ruffs, because he's naked and very pale. It is the brightest thing in the picture, and he's centrally positioned, and he's positioned and left to right in this sort of Christ-like position. Mm-hmm. And so you see it, and all eyes. This is not what Tulp wanted, I guess, and it's probably not. Whether it was what Rembrandt wanted or not is a different matter, but when you see it for the first time, the only thing you see is Aris Kind.
Yeah, it's much more a memorial for him.
Yes, it is.
But I do think as well that this is Rembrandt quite young. I think he's only 26 when he paints this. It's his first big commission, isn't it? And it's great for him because it's for a very important member of society. He's being paid well for it. And he's showing off his virtuosity.
Yes, he is.
The beauty of looking at art historically is you see connections backwards and forwards. You see how earlier artworks have informed Rembrandt and how he's sort of back referencing them slightly, but that he's pushing it into this new world of, you know, the Enlightenment, reason, science, that's all sort of looming. And that's why I love it. I think it is this transitional piece.
Mm.
But you've seen, did you see the postcard of it then? Is it that of this one?
No. So he then does a few years later in the 1650s.
Yeah, 56. I think,
56,
isn't it?
Yeah. He does his second anatomy lesson. And this is the anatomy lesson of Dr. Damon. Mm. And it's a fascinating story behind this in itself, because that all that's left of that is the body and the hands of the prelector, Dr. Damon, and one figure, because the rest of it was destroyed in a fire.
Mm.
And now, again, not sure about the chemical or historical truth about this, but it has been... One art historian told me the reason that this bit of the painting survives better than the rest of it, which was burnt, is because of the lead in the white of the paint is more fire resistant.
Yeah.
And so while all of the people who'd paid and Dr. Damon himself, who were all in dark clothes, they got burnt up. And the historical legacy of this painting is that the only person you can see in full is Black John, another hanged man. Now, it's a completely different portrait. I don't think it's still Rembrandt, which means it's better than almost all art. I don't think it's in the same league as Dr. Tulp.
I think he's growing into a new area of his style at that point, isn't he? He's changing the way he articulates space. He's playing around a bit more with that one.
Yeah, and that foreshortening you mentioned earlier is extreme
in this example. It's completely foreshortened from the feet upwards in that one.
Right. So exactly. The body is coming out of the picture.
Yeah.
And I think the scales of them isn't quite right if you were to, you know, look at it in a 3D version, because his feet look absolutely massive. But there's a very different thing going on there, and he's in the head. He's in the brain. Yeah. So
yeah, it's quite gruesome. Which one is it? Dr. Damon. He's right behind.
That's right.
Peeling open.
So it's peeled open, and it's peeled open sort of quarters with the skin, and you can see the exposed brain. So it is visceral in that sense. Now, part of the discussion that we had in the program that I made was that some of the contemporary ideas at this time are Cartesian, and Descartes is talking about his separation of body and soul, you know, an idea which we no longer hold on to. But there was a suggestion that the pituitary, which is an area, a small pea-like area of the brain, might have been the connector between the body and the soul, or the body and spirituality or God. And the suggestion was that Damon, that's what they're looking for.
You see, this is perfect for me, this idea that actually with the hand, and particularly in this case, it's the left hand, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the symbolism of left and right in, it is, isn't it?
Yeah. I had to check that.
I think it is. I'm like lying out now trying to work out. Yeah. I think it is the left hand. So if you look at Christian symbolism, the sheep and the goats, the right and the left, the right hand of God is for the virtuous and the good.
Right.
The left hand is for the sinful. So there's a suggestion by working on the left hand that there is, this is a reflection of this person's redemption. Mm. And the idea that you're going into the brain and finding that connection point between the soul and the body, again, this is not just science for science's sake.
No.
What they're doing is they're sort of padding it with acceptable religious symbology and also presenting the science at the same time.
Well, you can sort of imagine that, you know, the 17th century discussion between me and you or Rembrandt and Tulp or Damon, where in this sort of Dutch culture, yeah, they're talking about things like that. They're looking at it and that is the contemporary discussion, you know.
And the artist and the scientist are working alongside one another, and they both have different intentions for what they want.
Yes,
I'm sure Tulp would have loved something a bit more detailed.
But... Well, I think the irony is that this is commissioned by Tulp. He's the prelector. He's a big cheese in town, and it's named after him. And 400 years later, we spend most of the time talking about the body.
Absolutely.
And I like that.
I like it.
I like that too. And in Damon, it's even worse because the painting is burnt.
Yeah.
And they have in Amsterdam, I think it's the Museum of Amsterdam where Dr. Damon is kept, in their archives, they have Rembrandt's original sketch of the entire painting. Mm. And it's in pencil, and I've handled this, and from memory, it's postcard size.
It sounds amazing. We were waxing lyrical, Art Detective listeners, about the beauty of making television, because actually,
yeah,
one of the best things is that you get into collections, you get to see things.
People show you stuff.
And people show you stuff, and you got to see that postcard, and that just totally...
It was. So I mean, exciting. It was incredibly moving as well.
Because it's the original sketch by Rembrandt.
It was the sketch, so and because it's not a painting where you're slightly distanced from it, and because there's so many layers to it, and they're very heavily varnished as well, and you know, so there's lots of reflections and stuff. This is a piece of paper, and you can see the pressure points of having a pencil on the page. In fact, that is very present in the Leonardos as well.
Yeah.
That when you get up close, you can see that this has been... You know,
it's the scribblings of a mind. I just adore drawings and sketches, actually. Yeah. You're right. These things take months, years sometimes to work up. And they're so highly finished. And choices are made. Like we were talking about the hat being painted out.
Yeah, you can see the hat. Yeah.
But actually, the sketching, the lightness, the freedom, that in a way you're getting really close to the person.
Well, it feels really visceral. It feels like, and you know, it feels like someone could have scrawled it next to you. Yeah. So they have this postcard, and it has the layout, and it's got the, you know, various sort of blob figures with the body in the middle, and Dr. Damon holding, you know, a bit of the brain, and the preparator, and then various people. Now, they're all gone. I mean, they're all gone. We know who they were. They're all lost to history because it burnt. And even more strikingly than in Dr. Tulp, the only figure in that picture is the dead man, the criminal.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
I love these points where... the disciplines break down, and actually it's just about exciting collaborations. This is a collaboration between art and science. You and I are a collaboration between art and science.
Oh, no. Well, we talked about this a bit on History Hit, didn't we? That for almost all of history, there weren't these divisions.
Yeah.
And then we go through this period in the 19th and 20th century where, in science at least, as it becomes professionalised, and disciplines become ever more specific and more precise. Mm. And, you know, you were telling me about your PhD is on a very, very precise subject of bird symbolism.
Yeah, 8th century bird symbolism.
Yeah. And my PhD was not, it was on the development of the retina, but one particular layer in the mammalian retina.
It's always crazy how minute you go to begin. And then the connections start. Once you almost have the courage to step away from your specialism and start to explore connections. The connections are everywhere.
Yes, they are.
And it's lovely making... I love making the Art Detective because that's what I seem to end up doing every week is connecting with another person from another direction and saying, right, well, let's focus on one artwork and see where we go.
Yeah, and I think that you know, I focus on the eye and evolution and...
And we've got a whole other one to do on vision then and optics.
Oh, happily. More, you know, absolutely happily. But, you know, the eye is... I always found it very moving. I did a lot of dissection of human eyes, and I found it the first time I did it, I took the lens out from a postmortem, and I was holding that lens in my fingers, and it was slightly opaque because it was an old guy. But I've got this very clear memory of holding it up to the light and the photons passing through the lens and into my eye.
Oh my God.
And thinking, this lens has been the main source of visual information for a man for 70 or 80 years. And now I'm looking through it. And I remember just thinking, well, that's just odd and brilliant.
This is what stopped me carrying on with the sciences. I can't deal with those life and death things. I can't do. I had this conversation with Alice Roberts as well. You know, I can't stand blood for a start.
Yeah, that doesn't
help. But
also,
the idea of life and death, that would just freak me out to a level that I can't really do.
But how do you cope with anatomical paintings like
Well,
like
this
Toll?
Is the thing. I love the timelessness of what art does, because actually what it does is every time the new iris or eye look, sorry, the new retina looks at an artwork, you're reinventing it yourself. So it never really... It's constantly in flux for me. An artwork is constantly being redefined and looked at again.
Mm.
And one of the best art historians, Ernst Gombrich, he wrote very heavily on optics. And the idea that everybody sees slightly differently is key to understanding art history as a discipline.
Mm.
That we are all individual viewers and we actually all look very slightly differently at things.
Absolutely. And I think I don't lament the progress of an anatomical art into it being a more scientific discipline and being more the realm of textbooks for doctors. You can't lament that. But there's a period where two of the significant anatomists of the 19th century, the Hunter brothers, their anatomical drawings are... one of the Hunters... Now, is it William or is it the other one? I can't remember. Well, the main Hunter.
I'm leaving this totally to you.
Oh, God.
Where
you're
going.
Yeah, well, someone will write an incorrect or someone will just laugh at my ignorance. But was drawing these, I wanted absolute realism in these illustrations to the extent that he included reflections of skylights from the labs in which they were working. So, you know, you get those little... Cartoonists draw those little corners of windows in to indicate curvature and reflection, and they're there on the pregnant tummy of an anatomized woman, or the head, the crown of the skull of an anatomized newborn or just preborn, and they are very visceral.
Really?
Yeah, I mean they're incredibly detailed and a little bit chewy.
Oh. And
again, another big sort of fuck off coffee table book with huge pictures.
Sorry, Art Detective listeners, he's now
F-bombed. Oh, I swore again. I'm sorry.
Can't be trusted.
But they're slightly dehumanizing as well for the woman, because they're all about the baby. And so they're cut off at the thighs.
Ew.
But because he wanted this realism in them, they're cut off at the thighs so you can see all of the insides of the thighs. But the rest of it is the womb and the baby. And the babies look very still and sleeping.
And this is what date then?
This is the 18th and 19th century.
18th and 19th century, so it's moved on a lot.
Late 18th,
But you know the other thing that I think so interesting...
This is Burke and Hare territory as well.
Yeah, that's it. That's the other thing to think about, where it then goes.
Yeah, so stealing corpses in order to... Because they're hard to come by. And there was an act of Parliament which made it much more difficult for people to get hold of bodies, for doctors to get hold of bodies in order to... cut them up. So
no, we're going close to Frankenstein here, aren't we? Let's be honest. We've gone full goth circle. Yeah. We're now somewhere on the beaches of Whitby.
There's a thesis waiting to be written. The influence of goth
on the
science
discipline.
And art.
Yeah, on the science of humanities. Because I was just going to finish up and just think about this idea actually of what art does for so many hundreds of years, which is in the absence of a camera, in the absence of photography, only the artist can try and capture reality. And the better the artist, the more hyper-realistic and perfect the rendering. And so for so many centuries, we celebrate the great masters because they could paint and draw with that sense that it is actual life in front of your eyes, captured for eternity.
I think that's exactly it. And not just that, but these are also historically, until this process of it becoming more medicalized and more scientified, this is my new word, is that these are celebrations.
Yeah.
These are celebrations of of science and of culture and of art, and they're big public displays, and that idea that you pay to go and watch a theatrical dissection, and there would be celebrations surrounding that. This is a huge public event. And it's culturally significant, and it happens once a year in Bologna and once a year in Padua, and people go to it. And we have lost that, and we are squeamish about bodies and our internal organs now, in a way that I think probably it was I don't know whether it was absent but in the past, in the 16th and 17th centuries, but certainly I think there was a level of sort of visceral engagement that was sort of undeniable in a way that we have lost, and I think that's unfortunate.
I think it peaks as well when you start to get into the territory of Birkenhead, but also Hogarth, when Hogarth does his very disturbing set of prints on idleness, where you've got it's cruelty, isn't it? Where the final piece is a dissection, but it's a build-up of cruelty by kicking a dog and then hurting a horse.
Right.
And they're so upsetting. I can't look at those Hogarth prints without getting really quite upset.
Right.
And then the very final piece is the dog that was kicked at the beginning is now eating the entrails from the criminal who's being dissected on the table. So it all comes round. And the fact is that was popular. Let's not forget, because I think you say we're squeamish. You and I are both horror fans.
Yeah.
We are consuming quite gruesome stuff generally on television, in film, in a way that, we don't like it if we cut our finger. But actually, we're still engaged. Yeah. There's always been a visceral element of humanity, and it never really goes away completely.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point. Horror films they're not niche, but they're not necessarily mainstream. And I think it's so, and they are, they're for people like us. People drawn to the shadows is how I like to express it.
Oh, lovely. Thanks. I'll have that one carved on the tombstone.
Yeah. But, in a sense, people, I don't know, a lot of people just simply don't know what's inside us.
Mm.
And never get to see it. And you might get to see it in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or in a horror film, but it's not the same as actually understanding that this is how your organs fit together.
But again, I think this is one of those weird areas where science and humanities come together, because if you look at someone like Salvador Dali, who's creating surrealist images from his imagination, he's creating, long-legged elephants and all the rest of it.
Mm.
But that's drawn out of his imagination. But then I think that the scientist, Einstein says this, doesn't he? But actually, the scientist ends up getting to the point of imagination and belief very, very quickly.
Mm.
To go inside, to go out into space, to go down into a microscope. There's these levels at which, there's physicality almost bends and you go into using the imagination.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think that thing that we mentioned earlier, that bodies are more different on the inside than they are on the outside, and all surgeons will tell you that.
Mm.
And so when the classical representations in textbooks like Grey's Anatomy they look visceral and they look like realistic depictions, or more realistic depictions, even though they're still, pencil drawings or pen drawings, ink drawings, but they're not. People are different when you go in. Any surgeon will tell you, you open it up and they you have to have a good route around to see what you're looking at, because people are different on the inside. And it's especially the case when you're looking at diseases, which is, surgeons are more, they tend not to open up healthy people. that's one of the rules of surgery, actually.
But then again, that's the beauty of the variety inside, isn't it? I think it's wonderful. I think there's so many points. We have talked for way too long. We've talked for ages, which I knew we would do, and we could keep going. But I think we should probably wind up.
Probably best.
And we'll probably have to do another one. But thank you. Hope you've enjoyed it.
I have. No, absolutely. And I love talking about this stuff. I'm very aware that this is not an academic. I'm a fanboy of this. It's not an academic discipline. One can read about this and look and try and inform oneself. But,
And for those who are interested in finding out more about Rembrandt as an artist, we're using this particular painting as a springboard for this cross-disciplinary discussion. But Rembrandt is exceptional, and there's loads of other things. And that's the point. This isn't a definitive discussion.
Well, that's a bloody good job.
It's an open-ended debate. So thank you, Adam. It's been brilliant. You're on Twitter, aren't you?
I have been known to tweet.
I have been known to. What's your
name? It's just my name, Adam Rumford.
Adam Rumford. I'm on as Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And if you've enjoyed this, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is historyhit.com/artdetective. There's lots more exciting podcasts to come. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Nina.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.